Hey, welcome to the Joe Scarborough Podcast. Let me bring in Lawrence O'Donnell now. Lawrence, pretty early for you, late afternoon. I mean, I've been on your schedule before. This is this is early.
These are the first words I've spoken today.
Well, you have a very beautiful morning voice. I appreciate you.
This is my morning. Yeah, it's my morning voice. It's afternoon, but it's my morning voice.
I appreciate it. So I just, you know, Lawrence, you and I've always loved talking to you. I loved comparing notes, but because our schedules are so different, I don't get to do it very often. So I'd love to.
I believe, isn't this why you got the podcast? So that we could talk?
It is the only reason.
Yeah, yeah.
I have missed you. The longing. It's painful, very painful. But what is, I'm just curious, what's your general take about where the Democratic Party is right now, where the Biden White House is right now? Does it look like things may be coming together finally?
It does. And it's funny. The finally part is the odd part about it for me, Joe, because what I was struck by was how smoothly this legislative agenda was going at the beginning.
Right.
And in the past, if you look at the way Democrats lined up around Democratic presidents' legislative agendas, they tended to be open with their disagreements, if they had them, early in the process, kind of at the beginning.
Right.
And so what was really striking to me, the big moment for me where I thought, wow, this is going miraculously well, is when Schumer announced that he had all 50 Democrats ready to vote for a $3.5 trillion budget resolution, which they did.
Right.
And in the past, what that meant was you're on board with the 3.5. And yes, there's going to be arguments inside the 3.5, and it might slip down to 3.3 something.
Right.
There are things that can happen around the edges of it only. And now we know that, you know, Manchin had this secret note, which is my favorite legislative document I've ever seen, because I've never heard of that before.
Yeah.
Isn't it great? Yeah. Amazing. But you can see that he was being smart in his way to be self-protective, because people like me would be saying, hey, wait a minute. Why did you vote for $3.5 trillion on the budget resolution if you're not for it? And it turns out he was just giving Chuck the vote.
By the way, and could you explain to people that by doing that, he's a really good team player in saying, I'm going to do this. This is going to hurt me in West Virginia.
Absolutely.
But I'm going to do this. And nobody seems to want to hear this right now. But he did it because he said, I'm a team player. I'm going to give you this vote. I think it's total bullshit, but I'm going to do it because I don't want to slow the process down for you. And then we'll just negotiate it out. And that's where he had a sheet of paper saying, but don't screw me later on, buddy, because I'm going to have a piece of paper.
Right. And so, he did the process a huge favor, because what he did was allow it to look very smooth at the beginning. And he allowed it to look as though this is going really, really well. And people like me were sitting on the sidelines going, wow, I now actually believe this two-track thing can happen, because they just voted for the second track. They voted for the 3.5, right? So what's interesting is that the threads have come apart later in the process. And so we're now watching them kind of put that back together. So it's just a new shape of the legislative process, where these things are happening now that used to happen early on. And I got to say, you know, I go back in time, because there's just not that many things to compare it to when you're talking about a Democratic president with Democratic House and Senate. So if you go back to my time of working in the Senate, the president is Bill Clinton, and there's 57 Democrats. And I would say 14 of them, at least 14 of them are to the right of Joe Manchin.
Oh, yeah.
You know, who Joe Manchin is. When I hear people say, you know, moderate Joe Manchin, I think, wait a minute.
Yeah.
He would have been dead center of the Democratic Party, you know, not that long ago. And what's strangeful for him is that there used to be a bunch of Democratic senators to his right. I mean, not since he's been there, since, as we've discussed, you know, both parties have purified in that sense. But that's the way the dynamics of Democratic Party legislation used to work, is that, you know, you would never get Sam Nunn.
Right.
Never. I mean, no one questioned that Sam Nunn wasn't a good Democrat and all that. But Sam Nunn, Democratic senator from Georgia chairman of the Senate Armed Services Committee, he wouldn't vote for this.
No.
Never.
No.
And you wouldn't even attempt to talk to him because you'd go, we don't have him. Okay. Who do we? And you'd be fighting to get your 50, you know, for the reconciliation thing and let the vice president cast the final vote, which, by the way, is how Bill Clinton passed his reconciliation bill. Mm-hmm. He had 57 Democrats.
Right.
And he had this big reconciliation bill with tax increases, spending cuts, all this stuff.
Right.
And he got 50 Democrats on it, plus Al Gore, the vice president, right? There were seven who just said, no, I'm not touching that thing.
And we knew at the time, you were in the middle of it, but I was a lawyer in Pensacola, Florida,
right.
But everybody that followed politics knew. We're going to get there. You were going to get to 50. Bob Kerry, he'd get his commission and somebody else would get somebody else. But you knew, okay, fine, talk about it. But
Bob Kerry was the vote.
He's going to get his 50 votes. And sure enough, he did.
Yep.
Now, with Manchin, I've had a theory about Manchin.
Yeah.
I'm curious to pass by you on a lot of different things. First of all, Joe Manchin, you and I can say this, or maybe I can say this, maybe you can't. But I will. I mean, most of the senators in Washington, D.C. now are hacks compared to the people that you worked with. Politically, they don't know how to do a deal because they're on Twitter, they're on Facebook, they're raising money from there. They don't know how to work together. Joe Manchin, who has taken shit from everybody, I find it ironic that they're little 23-year-old dweebs with podcasts that will say, Joe Manchin doesn't know what he's doing. Joe Manchin. No, Joe is one of the few pros left there because he was governor for several years. He's slowly but surely worked through this. We're getting to where we're getting. There's going to be a deal done probably in the next couple of days. But I think even on voting rights, and this is where you may disagree with me, I've said from the start, Manchin knows that has to pass. The voting rights bill has to pass. He's reverse engineered it. He gave the Republicans rope. He kept handing them rope. Okay, guys, I'm going to talk to Mitch. I'm going to do this. And people are going crazy. You can't deal with the Republicans. Joe knows you can't deal with the Republicans. He keeps inviting them onto his houseboat. He keeps dealing with all, you know. And so now here we are. He keeps giving them rope. And then he says, here's my West Virginia compromise on voting rights. They're like, screw you, Joe. And, of course, Republicans are all laughing. And I'm thinking, see, this isn't a wise thing to do. Because this thing about Manchin that I remember, first thing I really remember about Joe Manchin when we became friends was after Newtown, Joe Manchin deciding to take up gun safety laws that were extraordinarily unpopular in West Virginia. Joe didn't give a damn. That's why I think all of this is reverse engineered. I'm wondering if you think I'm giving my friend too much credit or if you think that maybe he may have known what he was doing all along.
I completely share your theory of the case, Joe. And one of my favorite things in political coverage this year is, and I'm not one of them, so I look at them with tremendous awe, is how many experts on West Virginia politics have microphones in the news media and have columns. West Virginia politics is, you know, it's as, for me, right, it's as dark a universe as I could imagine. There's no way I'm ever going to figure it out. You know, I worked with two West Virginia Democratic senators, Jay Rockefeller and Robert Byrd, and they didn't really strain very hard to get elected as Democrats in West Virginia. They had to be friendly to coal and guns, and that was basically it. But the idea that Joe Manchin, the idea that a Democrat can be elected in West Virginia with the vote that state gives to Donald Trump.
69%. 69%.
It's the greatest political miracle I have ever seen. So Joe Manchin pulls the most amazing rabbit out of a hat when he runs for office in West Virginia. And when he gets to Washington, I promise you, Chuck Schumer, not for one second does Chuck Schumer think that he knows more about West Virginia politics than Joe Manchin. And he thanks Joe Manchin for winning and for being there and for casting the most important vote, which is for Chuck Schumer for majority leader. And everything Joe Manchin does after that, you get a free pass because you gave us the leadership. So, you know, he's, Yeah, I got to say, I've been hugely impressed with the way he works. And I would, as someone who's, you know, who's worked with these people, I'm sure it is and I know for a fact from people who do it, that it is actually a pleasure to work with Joe Manchin. It doesn't mean that you agree, and it doesn't mean,
right,
you know, you aren't pissed off that you can't get to the provision that you want because Joe won't do it. But you don't ever, I don't know any of the pros there who walk away from conversations with Joe Manchin mad at him.
Because Lawrence, at the end of the day, Lawrence, what do you want? What do you want, whether you're Senator Moynihan or whether you're running Senator Moynihan's legislative life like you were? What do you want? There's only one thing I want in life. Don't fucking surprise me. I don't want to be surprised. If I know where you're coming from,
right,
and that's what everybody always said, well, how hard was it being in Congress? That must have been really difficult. I said, it's the easiest thing in the world. I would just see people and I would put over their head, he wants this, she wants that, they want that. And you just, okay, that's what you want. Let me tell you what I want. I want to go back to my district. I want to be the conservative budget balancing firebrand. That's what I want. Let's work together. We can do it. With Manchin, he is a pro because you know what he wants. And that's what I love about progressives. Mm-hmm. Progressives who, by the way, have shown extraordinary patience letting two people dominate the headlines. Extraordinary patience. They look at cinema differently than they look at Manchin. Because right. What they all tell me about right. Manchin is, listen, Joe believes what Joe believes. And I respect the hell out of him for that. We just got to figure out how to compromise. Now, with cinema, they don't know where she is. But
right.
No surprise with Joe Manchin. You know where he stands.
Right. And it's a very interesting thing to contrast him with cinema, you know, who thinks that the only way to do this. I mean, I don't even want to use the word thinks with cinema because I have no idea. I don't know anyone who knows what goes through her mind. I mean, people wonder about it. But, you know, she doesn't speak. That's a fact. She doesn't speak to the press. She doesn't go out on the Senate floor and give an uninterrupted speech saying this is what I'm trying to achieve. Joe Manchin does his best to say something to Garrett Hake running down the hallway that will somehow illuminate a little bit where we are and a little bit where he is. He recognizes his responsibility to do that. And he recognizes that he can't, you know, he should not run past those reporters as if he's a movie star avoiding the paparazzi, that he has an obligation and actually does want to let West Virginia know and get a feel for this is what I'm trying to do today, you know, in broad strokes. And he's obviously being much more specific, you know, with the door closed. And so the amazing thing about Manchin is that, you know, he's still hanging in there as a Democrat. I watched Democrats just literally walk across the aisle and join the Republican Party in the Senate. And I guess if you're young enough and you've never seen that, it doesn't cross your mind and you start, you know, yelling at them. You know, it's like, you don't understand.
Right.
You understand. If you yell at that guy, if you keep throwing eggs at that guy's house, he's actually going to move and it's going to be worse for you. You know.
Yeah, exactly.
If he moves.
You know, in 98, I think it was, I got on a plane with Steve Largent and Lindsey Graham. And we were going to go out and camping because Largent, of course, football star. We're not sure. Lindsey was he just always showed up. Lindsey was just always around. And we flew across the country and we decided to campaign for moderate candidates in the Midwest and in the Pacific Northwest. And of course, I was on the other side. I was a firebrand on the other side. You're going to balance a budget in 7 years or you hate America. I mean, I was intense on balancing the budget. And the idea was, well, maybe if we'd go out and tell conservative Republicans it's all right to get behind these moderates, it's all right to work with them, we really need your help. I will tell you, Lawrence, just to follow up with what you're saying, when I left on that trip, I looked at all those moderates that I thought were dragging their feet on balancing the budget as the enemy.
Yeah.
You know, not, you know, they're my friends, but politically, they're the enemy. And you know how people would grouse, they're worse than the Democrats. Why don't they just become a Democrat? I would tell you, after 2 weeks on the road, looking at what, the minefields that these guys and women were walking through, I came back and I told all my friends, those guys are heroes. Mm-hmm. My job is so easy. I can beat my chest
right.
in self-righteous indignation. I'm going to get 80% of the vote.
Right.
Those guys, man, they're fighting for their life every day. And that's just like what you said about Manchin. Why yell at Manchin? He could, it'd be much easier if he walked across the aisle.
Yeah, and I think one of the things where he drives people crazy, and I understand this completely, is the way he talks about the 60-vote threshold rule in the Senate, because he's clearly at the point where, you know, he doesn't want to change it. But I agree with you. I think he's on his way to being willing to change it for voting rights. And so when he gets there, he needs to show West Virginia and his political calculus that I really, really, really didn't want to do that. And I think he's made the convincing case he doesn't want to do it. For me, it's interesting when you step up beyond voting rights, because, I mean, I'm completely against the 60-vote threshold for all purposes in the Senate and have been for years. I wasn't when it first came up, by the way. I was like everybody else who'd worked in the Senate. I thought, are you crazy? Why would you ever want to get rid of that? You know, and Biden thought that. And now they've all kind of over time, you know, come around to it. But what I hear him say about that and justifying it, that's when he gets into these riddles with himself. But people shouldn't confuse that with his actual thinking, because I personally, here's
yeah, exactly.
No, because so here's where my theory of Joe and the 60 vote threshold thing comes from. I actually think he knows, he agrees with Norm Ornstein and everybody else who's talked to him about it, that he doesn't disagree with a single point they make about it historically, practically, all that stuff. But he's in a situation where he wants to inhibit, he wants the Democrats in the Senate to be somewhat inhibited. You know, Bernie wanted to go for $6 trillion in, you know, in spending, right?
Right.
He doesn't want to live in the having to fight the $6 trillion, you know, situation, right? So he wants to live in a world where the playing field is narrower for what Democrats would propose. And the 60-vote threshold just automatically, you know, automatically narrows that for him all right. the time, like all the time. Like it always starts closer to him than anyone else, you know, because the ball is never in play, you know, on the liberal side of the field in the Senate. It's always somewhere else. And so the 60-vote threshold is what keeps it somewhere else. And so he knows, yeah, I get everything you're saying, but I'm going to say gibberish back to you because this is a kind of protective thing for me in the way right. I operate in the Senate.
Yeah, I love it. You said, I'm going to say this gibberish back to you. But again, when it comes to voting rights,
yeah,
I'm expecting it to be reverse engineered.
I agree.
And also, can you explain, because I've heard a lot of people say this, can you explain also about how Joe Manchin is standing in front of probably about 5, 6, 7, 8 other Democrats who don't want to get rid of the filibuster as well, that it's there are a lot of people that want to keep the 60 threshold. I don't think it makes sense anymore.
No, it doesn't.
Not at all. For the same reason I always told people about the filibuster. I said, listen, Republicans, you love the filibuster in 93 and 94. You hated the filibuster in 95 and 96, but it worked. Look at how it worked. Things got done. The country moved forward. It's just not that way anymore, Lawrence. You know, Obama didn't pass after the last 6 years, no major piece of legislation because Republicans wouldn't give him the 60 votes. And then Trump had his tax cut, but that's about it as well.
Well, you know, my view, and this has been my view for a long time, and I'm glad it's ripened into kind of, you know, a public conversation about, you know, Senate rules. But the founders, they actually came up with the ultimate filibuster rule, which is 2 senators per state. And so you've created an institution that is anti-democratic enough. Like you don't have to go
right.
from the 2 per state yeah. to now let's throw in 60 vote thresholds. At that point, you are operating so far away from democracy that it's a sacrilege.
Yeah, I mean, I think I saw Angus King did the calculations. What did he say? Something like 21, 22, 24% of Americans have an effective veto yeah. over all legislation.
Yeah.
Because that's the 41 Republican senators.
Again, to go back to the Clinton years, which don't feel like ancient history to me. They feel, you know, relatively current. But that's the last time we really had the Senate populated in a way that Democrats could kind of ignore, not be bothered by the fact that it's 2 per state, the fact that California gets 2 and Wyoming gets 2, because Democrats had two senators in Louisiana. They had a senator in Alabama. They had, you know, a senator in Texas. They had one in Oklahoma. You know, they had Georgia. You know, that's how they got to 57. You know, and Nebraska, they had two Democrats from Nebraska. They're never going to have a Democrat from Nebraska again, you know. And so that insulated the fundamental unfairness of the way Californians, you know, just have those two senators representing them and the Dakotas have four.
So tell me, Lawrence, I am curious, as a former Republican, a guy who still has conservative DNA in him, but who is now, I'll just say it, rooting against the illiberal party and hoping that good things happen to the party that actually supports Western-style democracy, liberal democracy. Tell me, why don't Democrats know how to fight, how to play politics any better than they do? Because I will say, when Republicans play politics, it's not that I have to explain this to anybody, like, when I was a Republican, we just play for keeps. I don't run to get 50.1% of the vote. I run to destroy the other person's political career, run a clean campaign, but make sure that, I always say this, that even his dog is ashamed to walk down the street with him after the election's on. I run to win and run to make sure that the person I'm running against will never run for politics again. That's just a mindset. And by the way, it worked, but Democrats don't have that mindset. Democrats don't play for a total absolute victory. And you've been around long enough to be able to explain why don't they know how to fight and win politically better than they do?
You know, I don't know. And I used to, you know, when I used to leave, when I was working, I'd leave Washington for the weekend or something, and I'd be taking off from National, and I'd be looking down at it, and I always had the same thing in my head, which was, it is remarkable how many people down there do not understand politics.
Yeah.
There's thousands upon thousands of people down there who understand policy on the staff and in the staff of the departments and all of that stuff. You're looking down at all of them, and you're looking down at the Pentagon where there's all these experts and all that. But the thing that is least understood down there in that place that was politics, which everybody thinks is the thing they understand. You know, the outside world thinks it's the thing they understand the best. And so, you know, I don't know what that, I used to marvel at it and just marvel and think, I don't know how to explain it. I don't get it. It's so interesting to me. Let me see if I can say this about your position and where you are in the world politically now. You want Democrats to get elected so that if you elect enough of them, that will ultimately be the only thing that can save or restore the Republican Party.
Because No. Not the Republican Party. The Republic.
Okay. Yeah.
We're the Republican Party.
A conservative party.
Nope. Okay. The Republican Party is irredeemable.
Yeah.
I don't see a conservative party growing. My hope is that the Democratic Party becomes the party of FDR.
Okay. I got you.
That you have progressives.
Yep.
That you have moderates.
Yep.
And that you have some conservatives.
Right.
Like, for instance, it wouldn't be bad to have guys like me, sort of Sam Nunn type Democrats in the party, because this party of Donald Trump, it's irredeemable.
Right.
There is no future for the party. So I'm sorry, but that's where I am.
No. Okay. Because I know you haven't changed. You're like George Will. You haven't changed what you think politically. You haven't changed what policy positions you would want to hold in the menu of choice, but there isn't a party for you. But I see what you mean. That Democratic Party, that was a huge Democratic Party, the FDR Democratic Party. And it was filled with conservative Democratic Southerners. It was just, I mean, all of the South, as you know, was Democratic then and very, very, very conservative. And they found a way.
Yeah, they found a way. I have always had enough confidence in our Constitution, in Madisonian democracy, that I don't fear Bernie Sanders being president of the United States.
Right.
Because I know Bernie could say he wants $6.5 trillion, but it'll end up being $1.5 trillion. I just need people who respect the Constitution, constitutional norms, right, the rule of law, the Republican Party that I've seen over the past 4 or 5 years, they do not. And I must say also, the conservative movement has been so corrupted. I don't recognize my party. Mm-hmm. I don't recognize my church. I don't recognize all of the tribes that I grew up in. And I'm not going to mourn the past because I really do believe, this sounds melodramatic, I really do believe the future of our constitutional republic is on the line every single day. And if that means voting for a straight line of Democrats for the rest of my life, okay, I'm good with that because I'd much rather debate Bernie Sanders over numbers mm-hmm. than over the fucking Constitution of the United States of America. Because I know he actually believes in the Constitution of the United right. States. I know that most of the Republicans I used to work with believe in the Constitution of the United States. They are not willing to sacrifice their powers as the first branch in the Constitution for a failed game show host. But the party, Republican Party, is.
Yeah, and it's such an important point you just made about, you know, you'd rather be in a party debating with Bernie Sanders about what the outcome's going to be. And if the party's big enough to include you and Joe Manchin, you know, Bernie's going to be the $6 trillion guy, and the party with Southern, and by the way, we could then even call them conservative Democrats.
Right.
It drives me nuts when people call Manchin a conservative Democrat.
Right.
That's just crazy, you know, but you could actually have some conservative Democrats, and you'd end up, you know, because of the process that the founders created, you would end up with reasonable outcomes.
Yeah. I had people on the show last week wringing their hands and talking about how horrible it was that Manchin and Sinema were where they were. Progressives were where they were. They're like, oh my God, this is the worst thing in the world. And we must be resolved. This must get. And I sat there going, wait a second, guys. This is what I was praying for when Donald Trump was president. I wanted a return to regular order.
Yeah.
I wanted a return to normalcy. I wanted the days, and I was joking about it, the days that Charlie Pierce would call me a fascist because I wanted to balance a budget in 7 years instead of 12. Those are the good old days. Call me a fascist for wanting to balance the budget instead of calling me a fascist because I'm actually a fascist. Like Donald Trump is actually a fascist. Because we can, as long as we debate within that constitutional framework, I'm good. Everything else, they're just details.
Yeah, you know, Joe, I just realized now talking to you that I guess a lot of the press corps hasn't seen legislative action in so long.
Oh, my God.
And they haven't seen legislative give and take. It's like, you know, it's imagine if baseball hadn't been played for 5 years, you know, it'd be, you know, what are they doing, you know? And so it, I guess maybe there's a little bit of that in the coverage.
Think about this. It's been a decade since the Affordable Care Act passed. That's the last time we had this sort of give and take. Nothing happened in the 6 years, Obama's last 6 years. Nothing really happened in Trump's 4 years. There hasn't been this sort of give and take. So let me ask, do you think it's melodramatic to say that every election is so critical that the future of this republic rests on the outcome?
No, I not only do I not think it's melodramatic, I'm also not optimistic about it. It's very dark for me. I just think, you know, we are going to be continually testing the very theory of the union, because it looks like you're going to inevitably bump into some very significant and important outbreaks of minority rule, thanks to the Electoral College and the United States Senate. And that's unfixable. You know, that's in the document that can never be changed now, the Constitution, because we're never going to be, you know, sane enough to do a constitutional amendment again, given what it takes. And so that kind of test, I saw a wonderful tweet today by someone who has literally zero followers and is following about 12 people, right?
Yeah.
So it's like, oh, who is this interesting person? And whoever that is said, and it had me tagged on it, said, it seems that what we have is a union of democracies, but that union itself is not a democracy. Mm. So you have those 50 democracies mm. where they don't have electoral colleges picking governors, right? And or mayors or any of that stuff. Everything is a democratic vote, you know, in those 50 states. And then you bunch them together in this thing and you go, okay, we're going to use the electoral college to get you a president. And then we're going to run the Senate this way with two per state. And you go, okay, well, that's, I just don't use the word democracy when I refer to the United States because of the Senate. And I mean, it's one of my little noticed mm-hmm. fetishes that I just never do it. But since working in the Senate, I just stopped. I just stopped, you know, using that word to refer to the country. But Massachusetts is a democracy. Yeah. And so are, you know, all the rest of those states. And so I share your threat assessment
right.
of every single day and every single day of paying attention to what, you know, preserving your government requires, including voting. And my vision of what's coming, I suspect, is probably much darker.
Much darker. You and Mika. And I found this with Democrats that I know and love is they are so pessimistic.
Yeah.
I think I'm probably too optimistic, but yeah, you're right. I do believe we're going to find a way through this, and it's not going to be, you know, with a party that uses a light touch. It's with a party that plays to win. I'm curious, speaking of playing to win, if you were Joe Biden's chief of staff and he came to you and said, Lawrence, I'm at 38%, I'm at 39%. What do I need to do to get this number up? What do I need to do to help McAuliffe win? What do I need to do to make sure we don't get routed next year in the midterms?
Well, for me, I personally would have been one of the advocates, and I'm sure they had this discussion. And I'm sure there was a vote that went a certain way, and the decisive vote was Joe Biden. I personally would have said, let's pass this bipartisan infrastructure bill in the House as fast as possible. And we'll go back and we'll get the other thing and, you know, have a meeting with Manchin and Sinema, you know. Imagine, Joe, if they had passed it and they had had the signing ceremony. What?
Yeah.
What is it now? 2 months ago? I don't know. Like, you know, it was before the Afghanistan evacuation, right? It was way back in July or something when they passed this in the summer. Imagine if they had the Rose Garden bill signing ceremony. Imagine if Joe Biden invited, as he would, Mitch McConnell, because Mitch McConnell voted for it. Imagine Mitch McConnell goes, which he probably wouldn't. But if he did, Biden would have handed him a pen, you know, one of those signing pens right on camera. And you would have seen this amazing demonstration of this thing that is going to do so much good for everyone, wherever they live. And it has that fantastic, you know, contrast with the Trump Infrastructure Week, you know, absurdity, right? And you just crushed that. I mean, I imagine that scene, you know, in the middle of the summer, you know, pumping him up, you know, a significant amount, which, by the way, he then would have lost to some extent in the post-Afghanistan polling environment, you know, but he would have been starting from a higher number.
Yeah.
And now you'd be in the same struggle you're in right now, which is how do we pass our other piece? And of course, you know, they didn't do that. Because they believed that they couldn't figure out how to bring the progressive caucus in the House along. And that, I would say, for me, is the only, I don't know what to call it. I would say, you know, missed opportunity. But it isn't, it's like, if you can't bring them, you can't bring them. But I personally would have said, let's work on only that. Let's work on getting them up here. Let's bring Joe Manchin in with them. Let's watch Manchin promise them that he will negotiate in good faith,
right,
you know, on the other piece. So that's about the only thing that I think was something they could have tried and didn't try. Otherwise, I don't have any second guessing for any of it, because it's all, I mean, they're facing a level of complexity that I personally, you know, never faced in anything I was, you know, dealing with in government. And so I have no, no second guessing for the way they've been handling it.
Yeah. Do you think Trump runs again? And if he runs again, do you think he wins?
Well, see, if I think he runs again, if he's not, well, I don't, I, you know, my thing about him running again has always been, tell me what his criminal record is by that time. You know, does he have a criminal conviction in Georgia? And, you know, if he gets a criminal conviction in Georgia, even though there's, you know, prison time assignable, no former president is going to go to prison. He would be in the custody of the Secret Service and, you know, he's not going to be in prison. So he can still run. But what I mean is, by the convicted felon thing is, tell me how much damage has been done to this thing called Trump by the time we get to the next presidential election. I do know he's going to be 78 years old.
Yeah.
I do know he eats too many cheeseburgers.
Yes, he does.
So, you know, he's going to do a certain amount of physical damage to himself between now and then. So, no, I wouldn't go so far as the win question, but if I had to answer it, I would say no. I would say, you know, the country rejected him before with, I mean, let's face it, a relatively weak Democratic nominee. I mean, one of the weakest Democratic nominees of my lifetime, I think, you know, the least dynamic of them all, the oldest. All Joe Biden was, I think, to the average voter was a good guy. Like, that's like all it took, you know, to beat Donald Trump was, okay, let's put up a good guy, you know, and who everybody kind of recognizes and, you know, okay, that'll do it. So I wouldn't bet on him winning. I'd bet on him running if he can.
Yeah.
You know, if he's kind of free to do it.
Yeah. Yeah. Hey, Lawrence, stay right there. We'll be right back in a second with more on the Joe Scarborough Podcast. This podcast is sponsored by BetterHelp. Is there something interfering with your happiness or preventing you from achieving your goals? Do you need some help getting to where you want to be? For Mika and me, well, we use DBT therapy, and what a big difference that makes. BetterHelp wants to do that for you. They want to assess your needs and match you with your own licensed professional therapist, and you can start communicating in under 48 hours. Now, like I've told you before, this isn't a crisis line. It's not about self-help. It's professional therapy that's done securely online. And there's a broad range of expertise available, which you may not have available to you locally. The service is available with BetterHelp, though, for clients worldwide. You can log into your account anytime, and you can send a message to your therapist. You're going to get timely and thoughtful responses. Plus, you can schedule weekly video or phone sessions, so you won't ever have to sit in an uncomfortable waiting room like you have to do with traditional therapy. BetterHelp is committed to facilitating great therapeutic matches, so they make it easy and free to change therapists if that's what you need. It's more affordable than traditional offline therapy, and financial aid is available. BetterHelp wants you to start living a happier life today. Visit their website and read the testimonials that are posted daily. Visit BetterHelp.com/GoJoe. That's BetterHelp.com/GoJoe. And join the over 2 million people who have taken charge of their mental health with the help of an experienced professional. In fact, so many people have started using BetterHelp that they're actually recruiting additional therapists in all 50 states. And there's a special offer for Joe Scarborough podcast listeners. You get 10% off your first month at BetterHelp.com/GoJoe. So I know you need to go. I wanted to ask you a couple more really quick questions. So I'm just curious. How did you get into politics?
It was completely accidental. You know, there was a Writers Guild strike in 1987-88. It lasted 6 months. And I was writing on Hollywood projects at the time. And I knew Senator Daniel Patrick Moynihan, who had been Harvard professor Daniel Patrick Moynihan, and his wife, he knew that my union, so to speak, was on strike. And they offered me a job. His wife, Liz, was the campaign manager. They offered me a job in their campaign, their reelection campaign of 1988. And I really think it was just, you know, he needs the money. Like, he doesn't, which is true. You know, how's he gonna pay his rent, you know?
Yeah.
And then I went, okay. And I didn't want to do it because I wasn't interested in politics. And I hated everything that is stereotypically Boston Irish. I hate the St. Patrick's Day parade, as you know. And everybody in my neighborhood who could tie a necktie was presumed to be running for city council, you know, so I wanted nothing to do with it. And I was afraid, as a freelance writer, you know, turning into a Hollywood writer, I was afraid of preserving the definition of myself as a writer. I just didn't want to do it. I ended up doing it because I needed the money. And of course, he won with 68% of the vote, as usual. And he asked me to come to work in the Senate. And I just kind of went, okay. And I did it, Joe, in a George Plimpton-like way. It was like, okay, this is crazy. I don't belong there. Just like George Plimpton should not be running plays for the Detroit Lions, right?
Right.
But I'm going to do that Plimpton thing of going into a thing that I know nothing about, don't know how to do, and we're going to see what happens. And maybe I will someday write the story of the amateur guy running the play in the Senate or something, right? Like George Plimpton did. But I went into it with this purely Plimptonian, spectator-like, writerly, you know, observation post notion of hanging around there. And then over time, it just got more serious. And I'm really flying the plane eventually. And it was just a kind of seamless,
yeah.
It was seamless from my attitude of, you know, when I signed up in the basement of the Hart Senate office building, you take the oath and you fill out these forms. And there were forms to fill out, you know, because you're getting employed by the mm-hmm. government. And I'm standing there. And I'm thinking this is going to last 30 days and I won't be back in Washington when I need this. So I say to them, where's the form for quitting? And they go, what? I go, where's the form for like when you quit, when you leave? They go, there's no form. I go, really? Because I thought it's the government, right? There's a form for everything.
Right.
Because I wanted to take one with me so I could quit next month in New York and not have to come back here. You know, that was my attitude. Like, it's going to be weeks,
that's funny.
And it turned out to be about 8 years.
That was also your attitude in TV, if I remember correctly. And by the way, my God, I'm going back 15, 16 years. I don't know. But I remember in my early days in MSNBC, you would always joke about how they would hire you to do a show.
Yeah.
And you were just like a writer. Like writers, they want their scripts to be bought, but they never want them to be made into movies because they want to resell them. Like the great writers say, oh, the great script is a script you resell 5, 6, 7 times. And so your attitude was with MSNBC, which had such a chaotic start, they would get rid of, they'd hire a host, get rid of hosts, get hire hosts, get, and they did this to you about 7 times.
Yeah.
And I remember the 8th time, yeah. I said, wait, so now you're going to do this in primetime too? You go, oh yeah, I got it made, baby. They're going to hire me. They're going to fire me. They're going to pay me out.
Yeah.
Unfortunately for you, they get the last laugh and they haven't let you go.
Yeah. So those were weekend shows that I was signing up to do. And one of them, you know, I signed like a year contract to do the weekend show. They canceled it after 2 weeks. Fabulous. I get paid for the full year at the full price. You know, it was fantastic.
There's like Jesse Ventura when exactly. I first got there. They paid Jesse Ventura like $3 million to do 2 shows. I said, I want that job.
Right.
Fire
right.
me.
Yeah, I wasn't getting Ventura money, but I was repeatedly signing up to do these weekend shows every 2 or 3 years. They would go, oh, we're going to get serious about live programming on the weekends. And then they would give up. And they finally are serious, and they have been serious for years now, and it's such a different world. And by the way, one of my shows, and I used to title these shows myself, one of my weekend shows was titled Real Time, which was canceled about, I don't know, 5 years before Bill Maher took that, yeah. you know, that title. Yeah. And that one lasted about, I don't know, 6 weeks or something. And I always believed that when I signed these hosting contracts for the network, that it would be like a 2-year term and I would end up working for like 6 weeks and I'd be paid in full all of that 2 years, you know? And so when I started this, the 10 p.m. show, it was a 3-year contract. And I thought, oh, this is going to be at least 2 years. of being paid for doing nothing. You know, this is going to be great.
It just, it hasn't worked out that way. Final question. So who's your, did you grow up having political heroes? Who was your political hero?
Well, not because of politics. It wasn't that we were particularly interested in politics, but JFK was a giant in our lives. You know, Boston Irish kid. I was in St. Brendan's Elementary School. There had never been, you know, a Catholic president. And here you have this Boston Irish Catholic who's elected. And it's hard for people to realize it now, but it wasn't the size breakthrough that Obama was, but it was in that kind of category of, you know, electing a Jew as president, which has still not happened. You know, if you were in that community where it had never happened, that there was a kind of, you felt some level of prejudice about it, right? And so it was our breakthrough. And I was a little kid, you know, when it happened. And I was in elementary school, you know, St. Brendan's on November 22nd, 1963. And, you know, that was a world collapse all over the country, but in Boston, Joe, the nuns, you know, we'd never seen them cry before. He was gigantic and a size character that that's hard to describe. And I think Obama has been that character and is that character for a lot of people. That little boy who was feeling the president's head in the Oval Office, I mean, that kid was experiencing something way bigger than what I was experiencing by, you know, seeing JFK become president. That was it. You know, it was that. And then, you know, I just became in high school and college, you know, an anti-war protester. And so they all sucked as far as I was concerned, you know. It's fascinating for me to now look back, as I have done, at people like Hubert Humphrey and discover, oh, so he wasn't entirely evil, you know, as I thought he was, you know. But I lived outside of, you know, anti-war protesters were mostly outside of politics people, and they were activated simply to stop this one thing. And you can see that there wasn't an ongoing movement that came from it, you know, kind of because of that, you know. And so they succeeded. They were the first anti-war protesters in American history who succeeded. It took them, you know, 6-7 years longer than they hoped, but they did succeed. And we didn't come out of it going, okay, you know, we love Gene McCarthy because he was running to end the war. Who do we love now? Do we love Jimmy Carter? It's like, no, it just wasn't a transferable. There was nothing transferable to regular politics from that fervor and from that protest position. And so I think people like me just kind of looked at Jimmy Carter and just thought he was just a regular politician. We didn't really care, you know, about them. Well, we voted for him. I mean, I always voted, you know, and always voted for the Democrat for president, but it wasn't like, you know, I'm really paying close attention to who they are or what they're doing.
Yeah. And you look back at LBJ, another guy.
Yeah.
Absolutely loathed in 68 and until his death. And there's another guy you look back on to see what he accomplished in 64 and 65. Really the most extraordinary successes. I mean, it moved us closer to what Jefferson claimed America was in 1776.
Yeah, but, you know, the problem that he had perception-wise is that he wasn't supposed to be there, right? It was supposed to be JFK.
Right.
And so if you lived through the period, it was very hard to assign credit to LBJ at the time, especially since we didn't know what was going on in those Oval Office meetings, and we now know a lot more about it. Because you always got to sit there and say, okay, well, what would be happening if President Kennedy was doing what would he be saying to Martin Luther King? What would they be doing?
Right.
And there's a perfectly good argument to be made that President Kennedy would not have been as effective as LBJ on civil rights legislation because he's from the North and he wasn't one of them and he didn't know how to talk to those guys. On the other hand,
right.
I was a kid at the time, but my sense of it at the time because I do remember those things happening, you know, the civil rights bills passing and that, that there was a tremendous, tremendous JFK momentum, emotional momentum on those things, that those bills were to this, to a great extent, energized in that tragic way as homages to JFK. And so there's this combination way in which JFK's, you know, ghost in effect was a factor in that legislation. And then the other thing is, if you lived through it, and if your older brothers had draft cards, and if your cousin was killed in Vietnam when you were, you know, in high school, and you couldn't find something good to say about the president who made that happen.
Yeah. Now the Ken Burns documentary on Vietnam, so damning, not only for LBJ, but Kennedy before and Nixon after. You just listen to the tapes. Mm-hmm. They all knew all along it was an unwinnable war. So anyway, on that happy note.
You know what? That's a perfectly legitimate plug for my book called Playing with Fire about the 1968 presidential election that includes all of those dynamics.
Well, talk about your book for a second.
No, we just did.
Yeah.
And it's it's fascinating for me, Joe, since I lived through it and, you know, was in high school at the time, that to learn all this stuff and to increase my respect and understanding of Hubert Humphrey, to increase my respect for Johnson on a bunch of fronts that I didn't know about. I actually came out of it with a higher opinion of Bobby Kennedy than I casually went into it with, because for me in 68, Bobby Kennedy was the interloper. Gene McCarthy was the brave one who went out there and ran, showed you could win, challenging LBJ, and then Bobby jumps in.
Right.
I didn't know. It turns out Bobby was trying to get in, or thinking about getting in before Gene, all this stuff. I'm just fascinating. And so I came out of it, you know, basically respecting, you know, most of the players more than I did before.
Yeah.
And that's an interesting lesson for the way we talk about these guys day to day, you know, because I do think, for example, people who are maybe whacking Joe Manchin pretty hard these days, it's possible that 10 years from now, they might look at that and go, wow, I wish we could have had a Joe Manchin, you know, in a certain situation. You know what I mean? It's you got to be careful with how harshly we judge these people on the playing field while it's happening, because there's always stuff that you could find out long after the fact that could change your view.
Yeah, I remember after John Lennon got shot and killed, reading the main Rolling Stone story about it. And the guy started by talking about watching Ben-Hur as a child. And he'd always watched Ben-Hur, despite the fact he always knew there was never going to be a happy ending. And it broke his heart every time. That's how I've been with the 68 campaign. Mm-hmm. Bobby Kennedy is my political hero, has always been my political hero. And I just never read a book on the 68 campaign or on Bobby Kennedy's life from, let's say, 66, June 6, 66, with his Cape Town speech, through June 6, 68, where I just don't have my heart breaking all over again. It is so hard to turn the pages as you get near the end of the book and know what's happening as he moves towards the California primary. But this is, I remember on the, my God, what would it have been? Maybe the 50th, no, not 50th, 68, nine, the 30th anniversary of his death. I got up and I spoke about Bobby Kennedy and why I got in politics. And it was the Indianapolis speech when Martin Luther King died and the cops said, don't go in there. We're not going to follow you in there. Bobby Kennedy pretty much stopped Indianapolis from burning to the ground, like every other inner city across America burned to the ground. And he made such an extraordinary difference. And I talked about his speech, and Jeff Greenfield came out to me afterwards, and I didn't know him at the time. It was the first time I met him. And Jeff said, you know, the thing about that speech is his speechwriter. He said, that son of a bitch waited until he gave a speech that he got absolutely no help from any of the speechwriters to deliver maybe the greatest speech of the 20th century. It's heartbreaking to look how he moved from 66 to 68 and to see how it ended in that extraordinary, remarkable, and I must also say chaotic campaign for a guy right. that was as disciplined. And I mean, he hated, as Jackie said, he hated like his daddy, Joe Kennedy. And you know, that beautiful scene in LA at the 60 convention, he goes in, there's all the Hollywood stars around and he's doing his work for his brother. And he goes, how many delegates are in here? And nobody was a delegate. He said, get the hell out, bring delegates in. It really, I thought it was remarkable that for being such a buttoned down, disciplined guy for his brother, he really ran a very chaotic 68 campaign. And yet it was magic. It was beautiful.
Yeah, well, you know, he didn't have a Bobby Kennedy, right? Bobby Kennedy had to be the candidate. He couldn't be the campaign manager. And I think what's so wonderful about the years you're talking about in his life, which are documented in my book and in many others, and it's an opportunity for people to, there's not a lot of these that you can find, but it's an opportunity for people to read about a politician growing and changing, and a politician in 68 holding an opinion that he did not hold in 65, and holding an opinion in 65 that he didn't hold in, you know, 55 or 58, and all that stuff. And what's important about it is that what people have to understand is that that was happening in the entire country.
Right.
There's probably wasn't a single American who was an adult, you know, over 15, let's say, in 1960, who had the same thoughts about almost anything
right.
in 1970. It was the most radical period of change about what we believed, change about how we looked, change about what we wore, what we listened to. But most importantly, you can find all that externally. You know, you can track the musical evolution. You can do all that externally.
Right.
Most important thing is that the way things were changing inside our brains, you know, all the time.
Yeah.
And that was happening with him in politics. And people mistake that, I think, when they start talking about it as political opportunism. Oh, he sees now he should think X or Y. And I think politicians right. are always subject to that. But the truth of the matter is the whole country was changing the way we thought about everything all the time.
Well, I had members of his family actually reach out to me after I wrote a positive review for Larry Tye's book, which goes deep into his connections with McCarthy. It talks about how mm-hmm. Herbert Hoover was a boyhood hero. Talks about this really hard-edged conservative side of Bobby that I think some of the family members didn't appreciate Larry Tye talking about. And my response was, no, you don't understand. That's why I love him. Because right. Bobby teaches me, he teaches anybody who loves Bobby, that we're failed, we're flawed, we can change, we can grow. And his extraordinary growth from even November 21st, 1963, to where he was in Cape Town in June of 66, that's breathtaking. And it's only 2.5 short years.
Yeah. And the thing that people have to understand is that every Boston Irish Catholic of his age was born a conservative.
Yeah.
Every single one of them, you know, right up to probably my age. And so when you see anything other than conservatism coming out of, you know, the Boston Irish Catholic in the 20th century, you're watching someone who, I promise you, evolved from from a different position.
Right.
You know, they weren't, you know, I mean, Ed Markey, I mean, we've never discussed it, but I promise you, when Ed Markey was in Catholic high school in Massachusetts, he wasn't thinking quite where he is now on the political right. spectrum. And that's not opportunism. That's growing up. That's expanding your view. Because Catholicism, especially, you know, the Catholicism we grew up in those years, is an extremely conservative thing
yeah.
to, you know, to begin everything in. And that's often lost, you know, people just forget about, you know, where did this person begin?
Yeah, I remember the 2004 Boston convention, Democratic convention in Boston. Our show would end at 12 o'clock, and I said, okay, where are we going to go? I need something to eat. And everybody laughed, said, the nuns run this city. Things still shut at midnight. That they do. All right, Lawrence O'Donnell, thank you so much.
Let's do it all the time, Joe. Let's do it all the time.
Well, we should, and I know the schedule doesn't work exactly well, perfectly for Morning Joe, but come on when you can. Would love to have
you. I'm going to find a Monday morning where I've spent the whole weekend resting, and I'll find the Monday morning, and I'll sneak into the show, and we'll have fun.
All right, Lawrence O'Donnell, thank you so much. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Joe.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for being with us on the Joe Scarborough podcast. Talk to you soon.